2022 had a lot of big things happen, a lot of mosts, but the ones we're thinking of are nothing to brag about. There were 29 global weather disasters that incurred over $1 billion each in damages, including 6 floods, 5 droughts, a windstorm, and a partridge in a pear tree. I just want to make sure you were listening, because we don't seem to be. This year was disastrous. Remember when flooding in Mississippi knocked out the water supply in Jackson? Hurricane Ian in Florida and Puerto Rico was one of the most expensive hurricanes in U.S. history. Here's UN Secretary Antonio Guterres at this year's COP27 climate conference.
The clock is ticking. We are in the fight of our lives, and we are losing. Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing. Global temperatures keep rising, and our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator.
Sometimes fastest isn't best. But while 2022 saw setbacks, there were also small victories. New York Times science writer David Wallace Wells, who blew us away with his 2019 book, The Uninhabitable Earth, is here to look at this year in climate change. David, let's get to your list. Your biggest story of the year, Pakistan.
Yeah, the flooding in Pakistan came on the heels, actually, of a brutal heat wave in South Asia. So it was a sort of a double whammy. But the rains were really off the charts. They probably pushed as many as 30 million people out of their homes. There were some estimates published that as much as a third of the country was underwater. Those may be somewhat high, but probably some large fraction, 15 or 20% of the country was underwater for not just a day or two, but weeks at a time, leading to a long-term situation where mosquitoes were breeding and malaria and dengue were spreading. Mm. The country is going to be dealing with that aftermath for a very long time. And it's a horrifying climate tragedy, but it also brought with it some, I think, silver lining, which is that it really brought to the front of the conversation this question about climate justice. Pakistan in its entire history has produced only as much carbon as the U.S. produces every single year. Mm-hmm. And in talking about these floods, diplomats and journalists and all the rest of us really focused on that disparity. And it ended up moving the needle at the big COP conference in Sharm el-Sheikh about a month ago, where for the first time, a new facility to address some of these injustices and inequities through the form of what's called loss and damage support was established. So there was a climate justice breakthrough because of a climate justice tragedy.
Yeah, it wasn't enough for the activists who were asking for more money, more aid from the biggest emitters to the poor countries who are not causing the climate change. But it was a great start, as you say. So there is that, Pakistan. Next big story on your list might surprise people. It's the Inflation Reduction Act signed by President Biden in August, but it does include the $369 billion to tackle climate change. But then, you know, are you optimistic it might actually do that?
Well, I actually would say that probably we're going to end up spending considerably more money than that coming out of this bill. It's sort of technical and wheezy to explain, but that's an estimate from the Congressional Budget Office about tax credits, which apply whenever you do the thing that they say you qualify for. So they're only estimating how many people are going to do that and therefore how much money is going to be paid out. There are also some loan facilities that were established in the DOE and elsewhere in the federal government that could end up paying much, much more than that money out as down payments on the green transition. So there's a possibility that this bill could be considerably larger than it seems right now, even just a few years down the road. There are huge roadblocks, though, and huge obstacles. We need to be building our transmission lines much more aggressively. We need to be approving solar and wind power much more quickly than we have been in the recent past. And in addition, you know, a lot of these Buy American elements of the bill may slow progress too. Like if you can't buy an electric vehicle unless it's been manufactured entirely in the U.S., then it's a problem that most of those batteries are now sourced abroad. And that's a special problem for the solar industry, where something like 90 to 95% of global solar production is in China. So there are challenges there. And of course, you know, overall, it's a much smaller bill than any climate scientist or climate activist or energy economist would have said would be, you know, game changing. On the other hand, it does mean that the U.S. is finally taking legislative action at a federal level against climate change, which has never been the case before.
Okay, so we'll keep an eye on that. But climate story number three from you, the war in Ukraine. Now, the Russian invasion directly led to the emissions of 33 million tons of greenhouse gases. That's like adding 16 million cars to the road for 2 years. This is a bad thing that happened last year. It's also affecting the global transition away from fossil fuels because Europeans in particular are turning to coal because Russia's oil spigot was shut off. Talk more about that impact. That's astonishing.
Well, in the short term, it's been really quite bad. And I think some of the headline numbers you cited are important, but it's also important to think in the global context. And that is that Europeans, because they were deprived of Russian gas, started buying up not just coal, but also liquid natural gas from the U.S. and elsewhere, which bid up the price of those commodities enormously and basically priced out huge parts of the global south. So you've had rolling blackouts in places like Bangladesh throughout much of the year as a result of this energy shortage. You know, in Europe, the prices are extremely high, and that's a problem, and the governments have scrambled to address it. But in other parts of the world, they're dealing with, you know, shortage of the actual things that they need to keep themselves cool or warm, depending on the season. And that's a much bigger problem. I think the good news here is that most analysts understand and would say sort of unequivocally that the major long-term lesson of the war is that nobody wants to be dependent on fossil fuel autocrats anymore. Mm-hmm. And that means that the countries of Europe, which had been playing this complicated game with Putin where they were trying to green transition but also depending on Russian fuel going forward, are probably going to be building their green economies considerably more quickly than was expected just a year or two ago. So it's a short-term hit, which also affects the poorest people in the world most. But on the 10 or 15-year time horizon, I think we may look back at it as a turning point for global energy systems.
Oh, wouldn't that be great? Well, your last story, the October victory of climate change believer President Lula da Silva in Brazil's election. Just remind us why that's so important.
The Amazon is an unbelievably important asset in the fight against climate change, and indeed in any effort to preserve the planet and its biodiversity. It absorbs an enormous amount of carbon, as any rainforest or any trees do, and it's been deforested at a very, very rapid rate over the last few decades, especially over the last few years under Jair Bolsonaro, who basically said to ranchers who are trying to cut down those trees to build new farmland, you can do whatever you want. I'm not going to prosecute you, even though the laws against it remain on the books. Lula has been a champion of the Amazon for a long time, and among his central promises in returning to the presidency is to halt that deforestation, which returns this incredible tool to the, to us in the fight against climate change, and means that we will have to worry less, maybe not none, because there are risks to the Amazon, but we have to worry a little bit less of that whole system tipping over into a savanna as is possible with continued deforestation.
Yeah. David, look, your book is devastating. We can't recommend it enough, though, Uninhabitable Earth. But you said after COP27, we're looking at scary but not apocalypse yet. But then there's a committee of geologists considering naming the era we're in the Anthropocene, meaning the age of man, meaning the age that man changed, you know, the course of the planet's future. Are you still feeling even slightly optimistic?
Well, those are two somewhat different stories, which is to say that we have obviously completely transformed this planet. Just since 1970, 69% of studied animal species have seen population declines. We've seen insect declines of 50, maybe even 75% over that time. We've seen a total transformation of the world's landmass from wild to agricultural. And it's now the case that I think 96% of the world's mammals are either humans or the animals that we raise to feed us. So we have already completely transformed this planet. I think it's undeniable that we're living in the Anthropocene. Whether we can continue to build a prosperous future in that context is an open question. I think there are huge challenges. Climate change is an enormous threat. It imperils the flourishing of everyone who's alive on the planet today and of future generations. But I think if we look back on the last few years and take seriously the progress we've made, which is to say we've cut our expected warming from about 4 or 5 degrees Celsius to about 2 or 3, we've cut expected warming about in half in just 5 years, we have to say we're moving in the right direction, even if that means we're going to fall short of all the goals that we've set for ourselves.
New York Times science writer and author David Wallace Wells. Again, his book, Uninhabitable Earth, Unbearable. David, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.